Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Tonight, we're very pleased to welcome to the store, all the way from his home in Boulder, author Daniel Levine. Like most people that I've met since I've moved to Colorado, Levine is from elsewhere, a native of New Jersey. He's taught composition and creative writing at the University of Florida, Montclair State University, Metropolitan State College of Denver, and currently resides at Red Rocks Community College. In his spare time, he likes to revisit classic literature and reinvent characters in shocking and dramatic and wonderful ways that delight us all. So please join me in welcoming, here tonight to discuss and sign his new book, Hyde, Daniel Levine.
Thank you, Michael. Lovely crowd. Okay, so I'm going to talk a bit. I'm going to read a bit. I'm going to talk a little bit more, and then we'll do some questions and answers. So, I don't know. Like most people, I first encountered Robert Louis Stevenson's The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde sophomore year in high school. I was like 14. And obviously it stayed with me. I didn't read it again in the years after high school, but 15 years later, I awoke one morning and I was lying on my stomach and my hand was lying on the mattress next to me. And as I awoke looking at my hand, I was suddenly reminded of this very particular scene from the original Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And the scene is when Jekyll goes to bed and he wakes in the morning and he's looking at his hand on the mattress. And the hand is not his own. It is the hand of Edward Hyde. And as we all know, or probably all know, Dr. Jekyll is, this is the classic story of Dr. Jekyll who imbibes this magical chemical potion that he's concocted that, when drunk, turns him into his evil half, his diminutive and exceedingly unpleasant dark side, Edward Hyde. And so what I'd like to do is, I'd like to go back to this scene that kind of inspired this whole story to begin with, and look at it from Stevenson's point of view and then from my point of view. And I should say, you know, there's obviously been a lot of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of spin-offs over the years or retellings. And my particular interest was not so much in just kind of recontextualizing the story or telling it in modern terms or setting it in some exotic locale, but in going back to the original that Stevenson wrote and sticking to his original plotline, his original chronology, because what I sensed was that underneath his original plotline was another story. It was this understory. And that's Hyde's side of the story, which is never told remotely. Hyde is always this very shadowy, very vague character. And we're told that he's pure evil. We're told that he's sinister and repulsive and again, you know, to use Jekyll's terminology, pure evil. But we don't know that what he gets up to. We don't know who his associates are. We don't know what his career consists of. We don't know what it is that makes him so evil. And so this was the story I wanted to tell. I wanted to try to give him not only a voice, but a perspective and a certain sense of justice that I felt was owed to him. And so I'm going to start with the scene as written originally by Robert Louis Stevenson. And this was written in 1885. And as I said, this is the scene occurs at the end of the book. Stevenson's story is set up as a mystery in the sense that you don't know until the end of the book what the connection between this Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is. You're not supposed to know that they're the same person. Of course, we all do now, but original audiences didn't. And so at the very end of the book, after this mystery's been unfolding, we come to what's called Henry Jekyll's full statement of the case, which is a written confession that Jekyll scribbles out in his final few days of life before he passes on. And it's supposed to be a full confession of his scientific experiments and activities. I doubt that it's full. I doubt that it's an honest confession, and which partially kind of sparked my interest in re-examining the tale. But in the course of Henry Jekyll's confession, this is what he has to say about this particular episode. Some 2 months before the murder of Sir Danvers, I'd been out for one of my adventures, had returned late at a late hour, and woke the next day in bed with somewhat odd sensations. It was in vain that I looked about me. In vain I saw the decent furniture and tall proportions of my room in the square. In vain that I recognized the pattern of the bed curtains and the design of the mahogany frame. Something still kept insisting that I was not where I was, that I had not wakened where I seemed to be, but in the little room in Soho where I was accustomed to sleep in the body of Edward Hyatt. I smiled to myself, and in my psychological way began lazily to inquire into the elements of this illusion, occasionally, even as I did so, dropping back into a comfortable morning doze. I was still so engaged when, in one of my more wakeful moments, my eye fell upon my hand. Now, the hand of Henry Jekyll was professional in shape and size. It was large, firm, white, and comely. But the hand which I now saw clearly enough in the yellow light of a mid-London morning, lying half shut on the bedclothes, was lean, corded, knuckly, of a dusky pallor and thickly shaded with a swart growth of hair. It was the hand of Edward Hyde. I must have stared upon it for near half a minute, sunk as I was in the mere stupidity of wonder, before terror woke up in my breast as sudden and startling as the crash of cymbals, and bounding from my bed I rushed to the mirror. At the sight that met my eyes, my blood was changed into something exquisitely thin and icy. Yes, I had gone to bed Henry Jekyll. I had awakened Edward Hyatt. How was this to be explained? I asked myself, and then, with another bound of terror, how was it to be remedied? It was well on in the morning. The servants were up. All my drugs were in the cabinet. A long journey down 2 pairs of stairs, through the back passage, across the open court, and through the anatomical theatre, from where I was then standing horror-struck. It might indeed be possible to cover my face, but of what use was that, when I was unable to conceal the alteration in my stature? And then with an overpowering sweetness of relief, it came back upon my mind that the servants were already used to the coming and going of my second self. I had soon dressed, as well as I was able, in clothes of my own size, had soon passed through the house, where Bradshaw stared and drew back at seeing Mr. Hyde at such an hour and in such a strange array. And 10 minutes later, Dr. Jekyll had returned to his own shape and was sitting down with a darkened brow to make a feint of breakfasting. So there's a number of interesting things about that passage, not the least of all of which is the powerfully vivid description of the hand itself that obviously imprinted itself in my mind to recall 15 years later. What I find very interesting is Jekyll's use of the first person in this passage, that he goes to sleep Henry Jekyll, he awakes as Edward Hyde, triggered by the hand, which is so different from his own. And yet he continues to speak of himself as I, as Henry Jekyll, as though he's peering out through the body of Edward Hyde. And this is interesting in that it kind of reveals this curiously contradictory attitude that Jekyll has toward Hyde in the original. One of which, especially in his confession, is that he's constantly seeking to separate himself from Hyde. He wants to shift the blame of all of the activities that they do together, the crimes that they commit. He wants to shift them onto Edward Hyde. He wants Hyde to be the scapegoat and thus to exonerate himself. He is merely the innocent experimental scientist, and Hyde is the criminal. And yet at the same time, frequently when he is in the body of Edward Hyde, he will refer to himself as I. He says, I must have stared at my hand. I stood there horror-struck. And so it's interesting and contradictory in the sense that it sort of fuses Jekyll and Hyde together. And it also totally erases Hyde's perspective. We don't see Hyde in this passage. We don't see his experience of this particular episode. We merely see Jekyll looking out through the cage of this body that is Edward Hyde. And so, obviously, a lot of the impetus for me to write this story was to examine this experience. To give Hyde finally his side of the story. And so what I did in creating the story was, in a sense, I layered it over the original, as I said. The chronology, the plot line are the same. And so in my story, we hit these moments of intersection. All of the scenes that take place in Stevenson also take place in Hyde, except there is this sort of understory, this underworld that is also taking place. And I would say one of the largest differences, and it affects this passage, between my story and Stevenson's story is that in Stevenson's tale, the change between Jekyll and Hyde is a physiological one. Jekyll drinks this magical potion, racking pain ensues, nausea, and he is reduced to this dwarfish, dark, hairy, ugly, repellent Edward Hyde, who everyone recoils from upon seeing. And so it's easy, in a way, for Hyde to present himself to Jekyll's associates, to his household, to his butler, to his servants, as Jekyll, in a way, urges Hyde to do, forces Hyde to do. Because there's no chance of recognizing Jekyll inside of this little dark, dwarfish fiend. In my version, I wanted to get away from this fantastical element, this magical element of the potion. And so the change between Jekyll and Hyde is less physiological and more psychological. Hyde is a distinct personality inside of Jekyll's mind. This personality sees himself as physically different from Hyde. He sees himself as stunted and misshapen and grotesque. And so when he's in possession of the body, Jekyll's physical form sort of contorts itself to around Hyde's nature or Hyde's idea or perception of his own nature. And yet at the same time, there's a part of Hyde and part of Jekyll also that knows that they're sharing the body, that knows that Hyde's face is Jekyll's face and vice versa. And so when Hyde presents himself to, say, Jekyll's butler, Jekyll's servants, all of whom have known him for years, there's certainly a danger there that these people might recognize Jekyll inside of Hyde, behind the mask of his contorted face. And that adds this element of risk and danger. And it also hints at this very interesting element. Jekyll likes to flirt with exposure. He likes to introduce Hyde to people who know him very, very well, almost as though he's seeking to be found out, he's seeking to be caught, as though this element of exposure adds an extra titillation to the overall pleasure of being Hyde. And so this added a certain complexity when I was rewriting the scene. So now I'll read my version of the scene. This takes place... Jekyll's been away from his house for a long time. He's been Hyde for a long time. Hyde, at this point, has a house in Soho. He has an existence. He has money of his own. He's able to conduct his own affairs. And it's sort of like being on holiday. Jekyll increasingly wants to be in that world. And so he's been away for a while. And he's finally come back to his own life after being away for a while and feels a little alienated from his own home. And he takes a hot bath. Jekyll padded, dripping, into his dressing room, struggled into his gown. He threw open the windows in his bedroom and slumped on the edge of the bed, streaming sweat. I could feel the silk sticking to the burning skin, the refreshing air wafting in from the square, the pulsing of the room, its expanding and contracting. We lay back woozily on the bed, the ceiling a whirl like a fan. The surgical theater. The dissection table. White sunshine poured through the cupola. Surgeons were working on us with scalpels and forceps while students we could not see watched from the ring of benches. John Hunter, the great father of Big House, was lecturing as he sliced a section of flesh from our biceps. We raised our arm and marveled at the sleek, purplish fascia under the skin. We put our fingers into the incision and began to pull it wider, and as if the whole forearm and hand were a rubbery glove, we peeled the flesh down from the braided tissue and ripped the entire sloppy thing off, strands of clear integumental membrane stretching from the webbing of the fingers before snapping loose. The surgeons were trying to hold us down, but we fought them off and sat up, hooked our fingers into the rims of our eyes and tugged to the eye holes, popped, and the whole suffocating mask of the face was sloughing free. Then awake, eyes flicked open. On the belly, face crushed to the bed. Morning light like a magnesium flare. Head pounding, beastly thirst. But couldn't even lift the face from the rough silk cover. I slipped shut into a blissful second of sleep, then jerked open again, staring at the hand that lay before me on the bed. Dead, disembodied hand. I tried to move the thumb, and to my surprise, it twitched. The fingers fluttered to life, too, arachnoid. I curled them into a fist, released them, fascinated by the simple action of my hand. My hand. I scrambled to my knees, heart galloping. Jekyll had gone to sleep, and yet here I was, waking in the body. I leapt from the bed and stumbled into the dressing room, approached the oval mirror and tipped it down. Oh, God. Wild-haired and bleared with sleep, my reflection gaped back. I could feel Jekyll recoil. I reached toward the glass, then peered down and experimentally pinched my nipple, a sharp tweak. Pain. It was firmly attached. This was no dream. I spun from the mirror. I had to get back to the cabinet. With Jekyll jumping like a frantic candle frame in the mind, I fumbled into his clothes and crept to the bedroom door. I peeked down the corridor. Pool might be anywhere at this hour. I slipped from the bedroom and slid along the wall to the stairs. I peered over the railing and down the spiraling steps to the marble parquet of the main hall, listening. From the main hall, I ducked into the narrow hallway leading down to the dining room. The dining room was the greatest danger. Poole always appeared within a minute of Jekyll sitting down for breakfast.
I tiptoed rapidly past the dining table and skipped down the 2 steps into the conservatory. I was reaching for the steel handle of the door when my eyes jogged left, and I froze. Bradshaw and Lizzie stood by the hanging plants 10 paces away, quietly watching me. Lizzie was watering a ferny plant, while Bradshaw stood close behind her, hands clasped behind his back as if surveying her work. A suave little smirk lay stranded on his lips. The girl was flushed, a guilty sparkle in her startled eyes. Clutching Jekyll's trouser at the waists, shirt tails billowing and the buttons askew, a sneaky lover escaping out the back door, I snatched at the handle and hobbled barefoot across the gravel yard. They did not matter. All that mattered was bringing Jekyll back. Up the stairs I scurried to the red baize door, where, with a spasm of panic, I thought, "The keys!" But they were in his trouser pocket. And then I was inside the cabinet. The key clattered into the glazed press. I pulled open the doors and slid each drawer from its slot. I had never prepared the needle. This was Jekyll's domain. And yet I could feel him guiding my hands, suddenly dexterous. I watched them operate, pluck down an Erlenmeyer, pour the crimson liquor into the flask, scoop out a spoonful of powder. When it fizzled down to pale green, I transferred it to the phial and jabbed the needle through the rubber plug, at last pushing a thin jet of serum from the hypodermic. I pumped my fist, pulling the tourniquet tight with my teeth. And as I steered the needle home, I did not let myself wonder what would happen if it failed.
Obviously, I changed it from something that Jekyll drank to an injection, which just seemed more appropriate to me. I don't know. I'll take some questions now. How does that sound? Yes.
You talked about the association from Jekyll sort of putting responsibility or whatever back over onto Hyde.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I mentioned the change being psychological. I'm going to take the long route to the question. I had to come up with kind of a psychological model for this case, this strange case. And it seemed obvious, especially from a modern perspective, that Jekyll's suffering from a multiple personality disorder. And a lot of these disorders emerge from severe trauma in the childhood, the need to invent another personality to either kind of subvert desires or to kind of shield oneself from trauma or discomfort or abuse, which is the case in Jekyll. And so Hyde, in a sense, was invented by Jekyll or created by his mind as a kind of whipping boy, in the sense that Jekyll extrudes him, he pushes him forth so that Hyde can take the abuse. And so Hyde, in my version, feels to a certain extent that he's there to serve Jekyll. He understands that he has a purpose, and that purpose is to alleviate Jekyll's suffering, or else to allow Jekyll a particular kind of release. And so Hyde generally has a fairly subservient attitude to Jekyll. Jekyll's the dominant personality, and Hyde is, you know, in many ways his proxy, his surrogate, his avatar, and sees himself as such, whereas Jekyll sees him exactly as that, as his avatar. He sees a vehicle that he can enter and entertain himself with, or act in a way that he could never begin to act as the respectable Dr. Jekyll. And so, you know, Hyde, like, there are instances of rebellion, but for the most part, Hyde doesn't see himself as a rebel. He sees himself as wanting to please Jekyll. He wants to serve whatever purpose Jekyll has in mind for him, which he doesn't necessarily know. And so Jekyll's purpose is often kind of obscure and murky
from Hyde's point of view. Does that, is that good? Does that answer it? Yeah? Okay. Someone asked me that question before. It's a great question. You know, I think of them as, I was trying to approach this less from like this kind of dichotomous good and evil standpoint. You know, so it's not so much Jekyll is good and Hyde is bad as Jekyll is the public self and Hyde is the private self. And I recognize the necessity of both in the sense that we all have these public selves, you know, that we have to present to the public. We have, you know, public perception has a very narrow criteria of expectations and points of etiquette that we all have to conform to. And if we don't conform to those points of etiquette, then we're abnormal or we're rude or we're strange. And Hyde doesn't give a shit about that. And Jekyll very, very much does. His whole kind of sense of identity depends upon it. And so, you know, I recognize the need for that. Jekyll is a pragmatist. Hyde is the sensualist. Certainly, you know, the inner me relates more to Hyde. You know, but I like to indulge that kind of inner fantasy. You know, it's this fantasy of, you know, like what could I do right now? What's the most outrageous thing I could do right now? You know, how could I shock people? How could I ruin my reputation right now? It's a gravity. It's an impulse. You know, you're drawn to it, and it, I don't know. You know, I certainly think about those things. The more respectable the situation, I find, the more the impulse is to kind of ruin it. And so, I certainly understand that perspective, and I feel the draw of it. But there's also the veneer that has to be maintained.
As you were writing, did you feel like a literary responsibility to the classic, you know, sense that was maybe debilitating for you as a writer, or was that more energizing, or what was sort of your relationship with, you know, just all the, I would imagine, literary authorities of the world, you know, on this great classic, as you sort of wrote and went on with the,
yeah,
with this perspective?
I tried not to read too much critical theory on the book. I didn't want to be overly influenced by all this kind of literary talk about it. I would say in general, I mean, the original novel provided a base to work off of. And what was nice was, I mean, I had this skeleton, you know, it was a skeletal plot structure, and it was exceedingly intriguing. I mean, Stevenson's novella, it's very short, but it's well constructed, and it has these wonderful moments of interaction and ultimately of climax that I felt they weren't kind of given as much juice as they could have been, or they weren't expanded as much as possible, or they weren't told in detail. And so I had these wonderful moments, these scenes that were already there that I knew I wanted to kind of reapproach and fill out. And then I had to kind of fill in the lower levels as well. And so in general, I don't think I found it debilitating. I think it was structurally very helpful. And it was also kind of inspiring in the sense that what I was looking for were also these interesting contradictions in the original. Jekyll's behavior, you know, we're all told, oh, Jekyll's the good guy. Jekyll's good. He's not good at all, you know, and this is not just in my retelling. You look at the original and Jekyll he's self-destructive and he's arrogant and he's egotistical and he's irresponsible. And he pretends to care about people and obviously doesn't care about them. He endangers his friends. He lies to his friends. And so this isn't a good person we're dealing with. This is a, you know, like a Frankensteinian kind of scientist who's, you know, way over his head and kind of pushing the limits and enjoying pushing the limits and wreaking, you know, reaping the destruction. And so that was all, you know, really kind of juicy material that, you know, once you kind of dig a little bit, it's there. And I wanted to kind of, you know, plant in there. Yeah.
So you kind of said that in the original, he went almost maybe even out of his way to keep
time thinking about why and where did you? That's a huge can to open.
Yeah.
But I guess like what it probably you kind of had to go down that a little bit to before you decided that you were gonna actually take that view.
Yeah.
Where did you go with it?
I think. Hyde is very vague, I think mainly for two reasons. I think one is that I think the less specific Jekyll can be, the more he can tell us, oh, Hyde is evil, Hyde is bad, he's the criminal. It's easier to push aside the blame. He doesn't have to get into the specifics. I think also, importantly, Stevenson was writing for, you know, a Victorian audience. This was 1885. This was an audience that was, you know, interested in sensationalism, but not necessarily in real life horror. They didn't want to actually get into the nitty gritty of what it means to be a bad person. You know, you look at the portrait of Dorian Gray. Dorian Gray, has this portrait. He does evil things. He remains youthful. The portrait grows more and more hideous and older. It accumulates the kind of weight of his soul. We don't know what Dorian Gray gets up to. It's very vague. And I feel like, in a way, you know, the Victorian audiences liked their horror vague. They like things very black and white. Jekyll's good. Hyde is bad. And so I think he had to kind of cater to that. I think, you know, he, as it was, the story was kind of horrifying enough, and many, many people found it offensive. I think what's nice is that we live in this time when you can kind of write about anything. I mean, you can write about appalling stuff, you know, and torture and, you know, child abuse and rape and murder. And it's like literary fiction if you do it with style and you do it effectively, which I think is wonderful. I mean, I think it indicates our kind of willingness to explore these very real dark avenues of humanity and to look at the things that we do and not kind of shield ourselves from it. And so I think that largely accounts for Hyde's vagueness, and I think it allows me to get more specific about it. Say, well, you know, what is it that Hyde is getting up to? Which, you know, I wanted to, it's nasty. It's supposed to be bad, and yet at the same time, you know, I wanted Hyde to be actually quite sympathetic, and so I had to try to balance that, which was tricky. Yeah. It's like what you're saying is like once specified horror is not actually so horrifying. It's like it's more scary when it's vague.
Perhaps.
Or my conception of what is horrifying is, you know, weak tea to somebody else, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, this was tricky. You know, I spent a lot of time trying to decide like what it was that the book was about, like what is Hyde about? Ultimately I kind of settled upon this interesting piece of Victoriana that was going on at the time, which was this kind of horrible sale and trade in young virginal girls that was going on in London at the time. And this newspaper reporter wrote this interesting kind of expose on it, but you know, young girls being kidnapped and kind of sold into brothels and the slave trade. And it still goes on today, but, you know, that seems sufficiently horrifying to me. And, you know, I was able to sort of inveigle Hyde in it without making him overly despicable, I hope. I don't know. Maybe he's totally despicable.
Did you wrestle at all with the idea of making him evil only in a Victorian context and really not having him be that bad?
You know, it's like about taboo, you know, And so obviously what's taboo in Victorian culture is obviously is much. Yeah, right. You know, there's much, in a way, you know, we're so much more open and we're so jaded. You know, I mean, television and movies are just horribly violent. And we're very used to bloodshed. You know, bloodshed is not shocking. And I wanted it still to be upsetting from a modern standpoint. You know, I felt that just to make it like, you know, Hyde visits prostitutes. Like, oh, that's terrible. Or, you know, he like, you know, goes to opium dens and like, you know, I mean, I felt like it needed to be sufficiently unsettling and unpleasant, even from our standpoint. And, you know, what's interesting is there's very little that is taboo. I mean, you know, certainly amongst like business or professional society, there's a lot that's taboo. But, you know, just amongst ourselves, there's most topics are actually fairly open and most things are, people are not easily shocked these days. And so I had to try to figure out what, you know, what are those aspects that still make people disturbed these days, that still cause people some discomfort. Yes.
Freud, did you dream Jekyll or Hyde right?
I think I dreamed Hyde. I woke up. It was very strange. I mean, what's interesting is, you know, this idea came to Jekyll and it came to Robert Louis Stevenson in his sleep as well. He had a dream. A man was kind of, he says, being pressed into a cabinet, and he swallows a potion and he turns into someone else. And his wife woke him up from this dream, and he was like, "I was having this great dream," and then he kind of sat down and wrote it. And it wasn't so much a dream for me, but I woke up, my hand was there, and it was just there. It was like Hyde. It's like, that's what I should do. I should tell the story from Hyde's perspective. There wasn't any element of Jekyll in it. It was, you know, waking up as Hyde and exploring that possibility. But as you say, I mean, certainly this, you know, 1885 is like on the cusp of Freud. You know, Freud was to come a little bit later, but Jekyll is certainly anticipating. Jekyll, as I envision him, is a psychologist. And he certainly anticipates a lot of what Freud is going to come to talk about. Yeah. Hi.
Will there be more of this kind of backstory of this flirtationship between Bradshaw and
Lizzie? Not really, sad to say. You know, the servants, I mean, there was this recently a book that came out that kind of explored the servants of Pride and Prejudice, you know, Longbourn, which is a wonderful book. And I couldn't get into that as much here, you know, in terms of the lives of the servants. I certainly tried to hint at them, and Poole, the butler, who was a wonderful character, certainly has a role, and Lizzie comes to a very bad end, unfortunately. It just had to be hints because, you know, they're not, Jekyll and Hyde are not overly focused on what's going on with the servants, only in terms of their perception of him. You know, they're not going to be kind of digging into the details. Well, this was delightful. Lovely questions. I guess I'll be signing some books and I'd be happy to talk to whoever lingers around. Thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate it. It was a pleasure.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.